Today, from the Wings Archives, another in our series about feminists and religion. This time, it's Buddhism.
I don't want anyone to get the impression that because I have gone through some kind of examination and exploration, Buddhism is now not problematical on the issue of male supremacy. Indeed, it is. And that is a continuing problem that I have to face. But then I love Buddhism so much. I really, my teacher speaks of being in love with the Dharma, and Dharma meaning the truth, the word, the way. And I am too, and it has served me very well. So I take on that, I confront that contradiction and take on that problem and work with that.
Mm-hmm. There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
Little by little, feminists are transforming the traditional religions. Shortly after the Anglican Church began to ordain women priests, the Catholic hierarchy decided to accept girls as altar boys. Women can now be rabbis in all but the most Orthodox Jewish sects. And feminist theologians are challenging sexist interpretations of Islam. But what role is there for feminism in a religion without a male god? In fact, with no god at all. In today's program, Sandy Boucher talks with Sue Supriano about the feminist Buddhists.
Hi, everybody. My name's Sue Supriano, and my guest today is Sandy Boucher. Sandy Boucher is a writer, teacher. She has her master's degree in religion. She has lived as a nun and has rewritten or updated a really wonderful book called Turning the Wheel, American Women Creating the New Buddhism. Sandy also was one of the organizers of the Celebration of Women in Buddhist Practice conferences that happened in 1988 and 1990. So I want to welcome you, Sandy. I'm really happy to talk to you. I just finished the book, and I think it's really a great book. I want to start out by sharing something that happened to me that's real relevant to your book and the subject of women and Buddhism. When I first went to a retreat, I think it was the first Buddhist retreat I ever went to. It was 10 days long, and it was really wonderful for me. I was on my way home, and I stopped someplace where I often stop, where a group hot tub thing happens on once a week. And this woman said to me, "Buddhism, how can you possibly be involved in that? It's so patriarchal. Ugh, yuck, you know, how can you do that?" And I was quite shocked. I was in a very open place after this retreat, and I think of myself certainly as a feminist. And I was, that hadn't been, that kind of thing hadn't been on my mind during this retreat, and I was quite surprised. And anyway, this is the subject that you're addressing. And I'm sure there must be other people who think that about Buddhism, that it's so patriarchal. And of course it is, but what religion isn't? So this is what your book is about, Turning the Wheel. And you interviewed over 100 women.
That's right, yeah.
So what do you want to tell people?
You're certainly starting at the crux of it. I mean, that's why I wrote the book, is because I also went to a retreat and began to do a form of Buddhist meditation. Now, Buddhist meditation is very universal. It's not gender-related, as you know. And I found it quite wonderful. But as I began to be in different Buddhist environments and as I began to study Buddhism, the texts of Buddhism and so forth, what I encountered was a very male supremacist religion, which had come from the Asian cultures, and they brought with them that male supremacist caste. Also, of course, we have our homegrown good old American sexism, and that was at work in the Buddhist centers too. I don't want to put this all on Asian, the Asian forebears at all. So I had to come to grips with that. Now, I had begun working with a female teacher whose name is Ruth Dennison, who was quite innovative and was very open to women. In fact, principally her community is women. So I did not in my meditation practices and retreats encounter these sexist practices and so forth. But I knew that in the religion at large, it certainly was there. So I wanted to find out how do other women, how do women all over this country, all of us who have, of course, come through the feminist movement, or so many of us have, with that kind of consciousness, with other kinds of consciousness about equality, social justice, and so forth, how do we respond to Buddhism? How do we encounter Buddhism? How do we work with it? So I went across the country. I interviewed about 100 women, Buddhist teachers, people who study Buddhism, women who are combining it with social activism, with raising children, people who had been Jewish or Christian and were becoming Buddhist. I talked to all these people, and so the book, Turning the Wheel, is a gigantic compendium of voices speaking on these issues.
Mm-hmm. And they're all, of course, women who find Buddhism really useful in their lives, that it really enhances their lives. And I have to tell the audience that I'm one of those people, so I'm not an unbiased person here.
Well, not all. I would say there, I included women who had found Buddhism useful in their lives and through various experiences had decided to leave it. However, I have to say it was not the practices, it was not the heart of Buddhism that caused the problem, because actually the heart of Buddhism is not patriarchal. But it was the events occurring in various Buddhist centers and so forth.
Mm-hmm. Well, say a little bit more about the heart of Buddhism, because I'm sure a lot of people have really know nothing or next to nothing about Buddhism.
Well, Buddhism is a non-theistic religion. There is no God. It is based on some basic truths which a human being called the Buddha, who he was not a god, discovered through intensive meditation. And they make so much sense. One being that we suffer in this life. We do not suffer, as the Christians would say, because of original sin or anything of this kind. It's just that because we are human beings in physical bodies and with the kinds of minds that we have and emotions that we have and relationships that we have to all of this, we suffer. And that the reason that we do is that we cling to things. Everything is passing, everything is moving through, and we're trying to stop it. Stop the river, as somebody said, and it doesn't work. And
especially
so we
try to stop it when things are nice.
That's right. Yeah. That's a part of the suffering is that when things are wonderful, we know that they're not going to be wonderful forever. It's always going to change. But the Buddha offered a way for that to a cessation of that suffering, which was, you know, the Eightfold Noble Path, which were the ways to break our clinging, to learn to step back away from our grasping and our clinging and our lust for things, and step back away and see it with more equanimity. This doesn't mean stepping away from life. I really want to emphasize that, because people seem to think that it's a basic misunderstanding to imagine that what is called detachment means that we don't participate in life, we don't have emotions, we don't care. In fact, Buddhism frees one to care even more deeply about life, about other people, because you're not so engaged with, you know, what do they think of me? What am I going to get out of this? You know, if you're able to ground yourself in some deep place through meditation or however you do that, then you can be truly involved in what's going on at the moment. That may mean being very emotional. That may mean caring terribly about how we build the deck or how we fix the car, or certainly caring about what's going on in the world, mm-hmm. social issues and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. It's been my experience looking around, and I want to say right now that we're talking about the for the most part, and even as little as we've spoken so far, we need to differentiate or acknowledge that we're talking about what I call the white Buddhist movement, and it's not totally white by any means, but it is primarily European Americans with a few people of color, and this is the kind of the new Buddhism in some way, although it's certainly true that Asian Buddhists, Asian American Buddhists, and Asian more recent immigrants are to some extent also encountering each other and have changed many things from what was traditional in Asia.
But there's also a movement happening to develop a much more international consciousness among, particularly among American Buddhist women, European American Buddhist women, you know, to understand and keep in mind that these practices came from Asia, to keep in mind that the majority of the women who do these practices and men are Asian people in Asian countries. Now, what does that mean? And they're doing them slightly differently than we are. Well, what does that mean? That means that I can't ignore the fact, let's say, that in a particular Southeast Asian country, the nuns are not supported in any way, that maybe they are so poor they have to beg on the street and live in rags. I can't ignore the fact that the Tibetan Buddhist monks and nuns who've come over and who, of course, all are desperately poor, yet the men are supported and the women are not because of the sexism within those cultures. Some people would say, well, what does that mean to me? I live in the United States and I do my practice here. It's terribly important. It colors what we do. It determines to some extent what we do, what this comes from. And what's happening now is that women, some women, are meeting internationally through an organization called Shakyadita, which means Daughters of the Buddha. They met this last fall in Colombo, Sri Lanka, with all sorts of Buddhist women, many of them nuns from these countries, to share ideas. In fact, I think this is the contribution that American women are bringing to international Buddhism, is that we're kind of organizers, you know. We say, well, let's all get together and have a conference and talk about these issues. So you have nuns coming, let's say, from Thailand, who've never seen a fully ordained nun, because in Thailand you can't be fully ordained.
And if you're a woman.
Yes, if you're a woman, right. And they do come to a conference like this. I'm not saying that it's in seeing the American women that their minds are blown. It's in seeing the other Asian women. Then they see a Chinese woman from Hong Kong who is a fully ordained Buddhist entity. She's a religious entity in a way that they are not. She's fully supported by the culture. And they say, whoa, this is how change is occurring. And that, I think, is the contribution of us Americans and North Americans.
Mm-hmm. Would that Chinese nun be equal to a Chinese monk, Buddhist?
No, I have to tell you the truth. The Buddha established an order of nuns 2,500 years ago, but he did it with the proviso that they accept 8 special rules that the monks do not have. Among them is a rule that says that any nun of whatever seniority must bow down to a monk of even one day. So they are not equal. However, they are very much supported. They're often quite educated. They teach each other. They work together. So it's very different. Mm-hmm. There are many, many castes of Buddhism in Asia, mm-hmm. in different situations, yeah.
Well, it's very interesting. I just read an article about the conference that the Dalai Lama had, not a conference, but meeting with Western teachers, when a woman, a non-American nun, I think, said, I'm going to have you do, I'd like you to do a visualization that you've never done before. And the Tibetan monks got all excited. And the visualization was to visualize that all those pictures of men were women, and that all the people sitting around who were men were women. And I guess it really blew their minds. She said things like, well, you know, we don't mind if men are there too, but they have to sit in the back and not talk too much.
That's wonderful. I wonder who that was. I don't know.
It was a Western woman, I think, who was a Tibetan nun. Yeah. And
well, that was also a very interesting conference because it dealt with quite a controversial issue in this country, which is the issue of sexual abuse in Buddhist centers and other kinds of abuses. And the Dalai Lama was very open to people's discussing that. In fact, they came out with some guidelines. I don't know if you've seen those, or suggestions about it. And there are people who will say, you know, there are Buddhists who say, well, that's making opposites. That is restricting the teacher. You know, the teacher may use this as a teaching method. Who are we to say that because he sleeps with a student, this is not a good thing, you know? So it's really, there are kind of two camps at this point. There are those who say, look, we have some common sense. We have a definition of sexual abuse, which is a legal definition. and it should apply as well in religious situations as it does anywhere else. Mm-hmm. And there are the others who say, oh, no, it's not relevant here because you're dealing with an enlightened person, something of that kind. But the Dalai Lama himself very much encouraged people to create guidelines to make sure that teachers live up to a certain standard. See, one of the problems was, and still is to some extent, that Buddhist teachers were isolated here. A Japanese priest in Japan had a whole superstructure that he had to answer to. He had peers, peer review. There was a hierarchy. If he did something wrong, people got on the phone and called up his superiors and said, this man is not acting the way he should. Okay, he comes to this country. He comes to Los Angeles or to San Francisco in 1960. There's nobody around who knows anything about him. There are no checks and balances. There are no peers. And here are all these European-American young people who've just been taking acid, and they're having experiences, and they want to put those experiences in some kind of context. And he steps into that, and he begins to do this. He begins to teach them meditation. All of that, I think, was very, very good. But in the process, he's isolated, and he's idolized. And what happens is he begins to believe what they believe about him is that he's perfect and that anything he does is Buddhist practice. And then he begins sometimes, in some cases, to do things which we understand to be very hurtful and harmful. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to say that it's only the Asian priests who have done that. In fact, some of the worst offenders have been Western men.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to Sandu Boucher, who is the author of Turning the Wheel, American Women Creating the New Buddhism. It's a paperback book that you can find. It's published by Beacon Press, and you can find it all over the place. And I really recommend it. It's very interesting, even if you're not a Buddhist, I think.
Well, I see it now as a book about women's spiritual path, certainly within a Buddhist context, but as I read it myself now, originally I was very engaged with, and so were the people who read it, with the specifically Buddhist issues that were raised. Now it's come out again in this paperback edition, and I've done some more work with it, and I now see it in a larger context, which is a women's spiritual path. How do we as women pursue spiritual practice and try to make a more humane life for ourselves and others?
And there certainly are a lot of women in the United States, well, in all of Buddhism, there are a lot of women. And again, they may not be in positions of, they may or may not be in positions of power, and that's what we're talking about, changing that with the relationship with the teacher. Actually, that's reminded me again of something about myself, which is how I said, even when I was interested in Buddhism way back when, I said, but I don't, I can't deal with this teacher business. I'm not bowing down in front of some man, no way. Well, now I understand it very differently. Mm-hmm. Would you comment on that? Because I'm sure a lot of people kind of see it that way, or they don't know what to make of some of these customs.
Well, yes, many of the rituals that are followed in Buddhist centers are actually cultural furniture, which has been brought over. I don't think bowing is that, but after all, Buddhism went to each particular culture, and there it became... It took on a particular contour because of the cultural values. So in many Asian cultures, if you respect someone, you bow to them, or you just bow to them formally because you're supposed to, and it's a way of showing respect. There are many teachers in this country, for instance, in Theravada Buddhism or Vipassana, who have all been Westerners pretty much, where there isn't any bowing. There are no forms at all to be followed. There are the Tibetan Buddhists who have a great many forms and are very traditional. So there's a wide spectrum. But I would say that in bowing, I now understand it, and partly because I did live in an Asian Buddhist nunnery for a period of time where I followed the traditions. I now understand that one is bowing to the enlightened mind, is bowing to the possibility of enlightened mind in myself. That's to whom I'm bowing.
Back to the subject of women in Buddhism, are there more women, do you know, in this country involved in Buddhism? I know that that's one of the things that's come up, because that's different than in Asia. is because so many of the women have taken so much responsibility, or the teachers, or the students who've been students the longest. So when something changes, they would be the obvious people to take responsibility.
Well, they're certainly becoming more visible. I don't know if they're, there are, I don't think there are more Western women proportionally involved in Buddhism than in the East, but they're much more visible. Particularly in recent years, women have been coming to eminence and have been taking their power within situation. As often happens when you take your power in a situation, very often you have to leave it. And that's true of a number of the major teachers who are very, very accomplished women, very brilliant women whose practice deepened, and they became wonderful teachers. And at that point, there was a conflict with the major teacher, and they had to leave the center. So there are a number of women who've established independent centers who run their, you know, and there are a lot of people who work independently. There are people who, I think the women do it differently quite often. That the women I interviewed, particularly in the last year or two, are talking about much more outreach into the community, not so much of the inward thing, which we did for a long time. It was necessary in order to get established here. Like, what is it to be a Buddhist? What is it to do the practice? But now people have much more security. And particularly the women are saying, all right, now we talk about compassion. We're talking about being present here with people. What is it that we can offer in the community? Here are all these problems. There's homelessness and AIDS and racism and all these things. How can we take our understanding, which we've developed now to some extent, and make that useful in the community? There are others who are insisting on different ways of practicing, not allowing the hierarchical system to be set up. There's a lama, a female lama called Palden Droma, who teaches in circles in which everybody, she says, we're all adults. We should come here, bring our lives. We all talk to each other about what's going on in our lives. She has been ordained as a lama and could wear the robes, could assume the position, the traditional position, has chosen not to do that and to enter into a circle form with people. So women are doing a lot that was never dreamt of in Asia, in Asian Buddhism.
I'd be interested in hearing some more examples of things that they're doing different.
Mm-hmm. Well, for instance, there is a woman called Soltram Alioni, who was, in fact, a Tibetan Buddhist nun when she was quite young. I think she was 19 when she ordained, and then left the robes and raised children and was married several times, became a feminist and so forth, and now is teaching. She's teaching using a lot of very innovative stuff, psychological techniques, dance, mask making, all of that. And what she says is not that psychology can take the place of the Buddhist practices, but what she says is that we have a sort of shield around us, and we hang Buddhism on the shield like a little medal, and we say, oh, now we're Buddhists. And she says, through these psychological practices, you break that shield open, and then the Buddhist practices can enter you deeply and transform you. So she does these workshops all over the country, and also all over the world. She does them in Bali and in Hawaii and various places. There's a woman named Irina Weissman in Massachusetts, who does workshops on overcoming racism. She does workshops on gay and lesbian approaches to Buddhist practice. Whatever she sees as in our face in the community that's causing friction, she moves into that and does something there. Julie Wester she had done a lot of workshops with women, and now she's working with men and women, and she said she's deliberately taking all the techniques and what she learned with the women into her workshops with men, and sort of letting that enrich the environment. So I think a lot of people are doing interesting things.
And yet these women, I'm assuming not just in the way of hanging the label on the outside of their shield, which is kind of like their ego, it seems like, come back to Buddhism. Or this is, you're still talking like in your book, Turning the Wheel, American Women Creating the New Buddhism. So just to kind of come around in a circle here, the Buddhism is still there and still important.
It's at the heart, yes, and it's combined with a number of things. A number of women are combining it with deep ecology and anti-nuclear work. You know, there's a great deal of political work. There's also the establishment of the Interracial Buddhist Council, which is trying to deal with those issues. But you know, there really isn't any friction. The political work I do, I don't find that that is in conflict with my Buddhist principles or with my Buddhist understanding, which is a softening and an enlarging and an inclusion of all of life. And once you begin to feel that, then it is appropriate, really, to move in response to what you see out there.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. My guest is Sandy Boucher, B-O-U-C-H-E-R, author of Turning the Wheel, American Women Creating the New Buddhism. So, Sandy, in the couple remaining minutes, not even, what do you want to leave people with?
Well, I don't want anyone to get the impression that because I have gone through some kind of examination and exploration, Buddhism is now not problematical on the issue of male supremacy. Indeed, it is. And that is a continuing problem that I have to face. But then I love Buddhism so much. I really, my teacher speaks of being in love with the Dharma, and Dharma meaning the truth, the word, the way. And I am too, and it has served me very well. So I take on that, I confront that contradiction and take on that problem and work with that.
Mm-hmm. And anyway, I don't know where you can escape male supremacy.
This was pointed out by a feminist theologian at the Graduate Theological Union. Someone said, well, why don't we just go off and create a women's religion? And she said, no, but you still live in the patriarchy. You can do what you want, but you live in the patriarchy. And you know, and if you're going to be honest with it, you confront it. You confront it daily and work with it.
Okay, well, thank you so much, Sandy Boucher, author of Turning the Wheel, American Women Creating the New Buddhism. It's published by Beacon Press. And you can find it all over the place. My name's Sue Supriano. Thanks a lot for listening.
This program was recorded in 1994. Sandy Boucher now has 9 books to her credit, including Discovering Kuan Yin, Buddhist Goddess of Compassion, Hidden Spring, A Buddhist Woman Confronts Cancer, Dancing in the Dharma, The Life and Teachings of Ruth Denison, and Opening the Lotus, A Woman's Guide to Buddhism. She also publishes articles on tricycle.org. Unfortunately, the interviewer Sue Supriano died in 2015. She and her radio series Steppin' Out of Babylon are still missed. To hear Wings programs again, email wings@wings.org or visit our website, wingsradio.org/WordPress. You can also view our news feed on Facebook, wingsradio.org. Wings thanks all our contributing producers and the many community and campus radio stations that broadcast the shows in this series. Our recent supporters include the U.S. chapter of the International Association of Women in Radio and Television, WERU-FM in Blue Hill, Maine, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughn, whose series of salons can be viewed on the website maternalgifteconomymovement.org. That's all one word, maternalgifteconomymovement.org. The Wing Sound logo is from Libana's album A Circle is Cast. I'm Frieda Worden. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.
You are listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, SFU Burnaby.
Studio 6, CJSF's video series, captures high-quality video recordings of live performances.
So, who are you?
With impactful and inspiring artists.
We weren't very good at keeping it a secret.
As well as engaging conversations with community members about the issues that are most important to their communities. watch all of the Studio 6 live sessions on CJSF's YouTube page or on our website at cjsf.ca/studio6.